Ensuring engagement agreements, kind of consistent with that, building on that, is an area that's pretty unique to Texas malpractice law because of the fact that you're talking about a contract that's entered into between a fiduciary and the client. So there are some, although normal contract construction rules apply, an unambiguous engagement agreement is enforceable the same way as any other unambiguous contract is enforceable, there are unique rules, construction rules, that also layer on top of that because of that fiduciary relationship. So let's say you're in a relationship with a client already, and midway through the client's having trouble paying their fees and they want to change to a contingency fee. Well, that makes sense. It benefits the client. Maybe you can come up with a fee arrangement that benefits you as well, but you got to be real careful when you do that, because when you enter into an agreement during the attorney-client relationship, the law puts a presumption there that the agreement is unfair to the client. So the attorney has a burden to rebut that presumption by proving that the agreement was fair if there's litigation that results. So that's one unique issue that you always want to be aware of. Another is that even for sort of the typical engagement agreement that's entered into at the outset of the representation, you're still layering on that fiduciary duty that's owed. Attorneys owe fiduciary duties of clarity and of high standards of conduct and fair dealing. In other words, those DRs are essentially being imported into the disciplinary rules of professional conduct, are being imported into your engagement agreement. And so recent Supreme Court cases have really talked about that in the context of fees, in the context of arbitration, in the context of what are the attorneys, the scope of the attorney's duties to the client. There's a lot there, but the bottom line is that the court has said, because of all those fiduciary duties, you're construing the engagement agreements from the standpoint of a reasonable person in the client's position. So you have to just take that time to be extra clear, and if in doubt, put more words in there to make the fee clear, how you're going to calculate it, who you're representing. If you've got conflicts issues, it never hurts to put a little more detail in there about what the issues are with conflicts, and always consult the disciplinary rules when you're putting together a fee or an engagement agreement in a situation where you feel like it's a little bit unusual. You just really want to always double check. So, of course, this leads to malpractice liability, how we prove these cases. It's a negligence claim. In many ways, it's a straightforward negligence claim: duty, breach, causation, damages. But what's unique about it, of course, is that a lot of the time, these cases arise out of litigation. So proving them becomes a bit complicated and unique. Another unique aspect is that the ethics rules come in. The disciplinary rules do not, per se, if you violate a disciplinary rule when you're representing a client, that doesn't automatically mean that you're liable. It doesn't, per se, establish liability. But you can reasonably expect that the experts on both sides in the legal malpractice case are going to be talking about the DRs and whether or not you violated them. The DRs are admissible in order to sort of frame what your duties are. The other unique issue, and there are Supreme Court cases that have come out on this recently as well, is that expert testimony is generally needed on the standard of care as well as on causation and damages. Now, there are a couple of limited exceptions to that. I mean, if you totally blow a deadline and limitations is gone, you know, the plaintiff is not going to need an expert to come in and say that you breached the standard of care, but the plaintiff will still probably need an expert to talk about how that impacted the underlying case. So most of the time, you should expect that experts are going to be needed on both sides in these cases. Now, with causation, typically with the legal malpractice cases, what you see is what's referred to as the case within the case, and that's where all the sort of the layers and the nuance and the complexity often comes in with these cases. The Aiken-Gump case describes this causation standard in an easy-to-follow way. When the claim is that lawyers improperly represented the plaintiff in another case, the plaintiff must prove and obtain findings as to the amount of damages that would have been recoverable and collected if the case had been properly prosecuted. So you're essentially talking about a hypothetical retrying of that underlying lawsuit to show what would have happened and to show that the plaintiff would have been able to collect on that judgment. You can imagine that depending on the type of case at issue, a lot of complexities can come out of how do you prove that? Appellate causation, what happens when you commit malpractice in an appeal? How do you prove that? Well, the Supreme Court has said that's a question of law, which makes sense. The appeals court is going to be resolving your appeal as a question of law. So obviously when you get to the malpractice case, what should have happened in the appeal would also be a question of law. But that leads to such an interesting situation, I think, because what you end up having is most likely a summary judgment by the lawyer on this causation issue or by the plaintiff, either way. And you're going to have the entire appellate record coming into your summary judgment. And the trial court in the malpractice case is going to be deciding summary judgment based on the appellate record from the underlying appeal, essentially deciding the underlying appeal a second time. So that's kind of an example of how these cases can play out in all sorts of different interesting ways. So appellate causation, it's a matter of law. Arguably, you don't even need an expert because of that. But most other case within the case situations, there does need to be expert testimony, and the Supreme Court cases that have come out recently illustrate this. The first case is Alexander versus Turter. That arose out of a bankruptcy. The partner, Mr. Alexander, did not try the case himself, the bankruptcy case. He sent an associate to do it instead. The associate lost, and the client had an adverse outcome and sued. In the legal malpractice case, the plaintiff presented expert testimony on breach.